Welcome to the Wicked Wallflowers Club. I'm Jenny Nordback.
And I'm Sarah Hawley.
Today, we are here with author Emma Berry. We talk about her most recent release in her Astronaut series, which is Free Fall, as well as fan favorite Earthbound.
We also discuss assigning Hogwarts houses to her characters, her distressingly phallic attempts to make lobster jello, and her journey from never having read a romance to writing novels and teaching a course about them in less than 7 years. Without further ado, here is our interview with Emma Berry.
We are super excited to be here with Emma Berry today. Thanks for being with us, Emma.
It's my pleasure.
And we usually start by asking authors if they remember what their very first romance novel was that they read.
I have an incredibly specific memory of it. So it was about 7 years ago, and my kids had just been born. I have twins who are now seven. And I was not sleeping like at all. And it was right after Christmas, and I'd gotten the Kindle for Christmas and then like a bunch of Amazon gift cards. And so I had this Kindle and like all this money to load on it. And one of my professors, I was in grad school at the time, mentioned that she was teaching a romance novel in her women's literature class. And I, like the very elitist academic I was like, oh, I've never read one of those. I should read like one. And I Googled best romance novel ever, and I found the All About Romance list, and the number one book on the list is Lord of Scoundrels. And so I was like, oh, well, that should be my one romance novel, right? And I read Lord of Scoundrels, and I loved it. It was like the most fun that I had had reading basically ever, certainly since I started grad school. And it's hard, like I can't reread the book now because there's a lot about it that is problematic in terms of sort of the casual like racism and Orientalism and colonialism in the book, and there's some slut shaming. So like it's not a book that I recommend people start with necessarily, but it is there's also a side of it that is very delightful. And at that point, all I was seeing was the delightful. I was not seeing the problematic content. So yeah, that was my first romance novel, and like Pringles, like by the end of the year, I'd read like 250 romance novels. I did not read just one. I was reading like one a day because I was like breastfeeding twins and I wasn't teaching. And so like, it was all crazy. And yeah, I did not stop at one. That did not work out.
I feel like Lord of Scoundrels is one of these books that's, it's so hazy in our memory. Cause also I remember it being one of the first ones I read and I was obsessed with it. And I was like, oh, Lord of Scoundrels. Mm-hmm. And then someone was reading it for the first time and tweeting their reactions. And they were like, wow, this is racist. And I was like, I don't remember that at all. I have these like this golden tinted memory of Lord of Scoundrels as this like perfect entertaining book. But it is interesting as we read more and just become more aware that, yeah, like maybe that isn't the best place to start. Whereas I feel like before people would have been like, oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Read Lord of Scoundrels. You'll love it.
Yeah. I mean, and the other chase that I can't reread is Mr. Impossible, which I loved so much, but there's just, that book is so colonial. Like when I need to read Chase, I reread like Lord Perfect and Last Night's Scandal, which I love. And there's a little bit of that, but it's not as bad as unfortunately I think those two are. And again, there's just the charming writing, but some problematic.
So is Mr. Impossible, I don't think I read that one. Is that the one where they go to Egypt?
Yes. And it's basically like The Mummy, but without like the mummy stuff.
Okay.
And the heroine is like an Egyptologist, and the hero, everyone calls him a beta hero. And like, I will fight people over this. He is not a beta hero. But I love that book. But yeah, this, the colonialism in it is overwhelming.
Yeah. I think Meredith Duran, Bound by Your Touch, also has an Egyptologist heroine, but she tends to be a lot more aware of colonialism and some of the ills that archaeologists have done to society. Jenny and I both have an archaeology background, so we are well aware of the role archaeology has played in oppressing local populations, which is not something we really need to talk about in this romance podcast. But it is interesting that it's so romanticized, and then you start to unpack it and you're like, wow, this is really, really awful.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it's with Chase, the writing is so good. And like, I agree that Duran handles it better. So it's complicated. So complicated.
Yeah. And okay. So non-problematic books. Yours.
Sorry, that was like probably not the right
No, it's
start.
Totally, but I mean, our listeners know what we're like by now, so we're okay. They're not surprised, but so we found you via Jenny Holiday. During her interview, she listed Parsons as her favorite mm-hmm. book boyfriend, and Parsons is from, is he Earthbound?
Earthbound.
Yeah, pausing on titles.
Yeah.
Okay, so
it's okay.
He's from Earthbound, and So I immediately went and read Earthbound and was like, holy shit, yes, Parsons is amazing. And it's Parsons and Charlie. So I thought you could start by telling us about Earthbound and then we can kind of jump to some of the other books.
Of course. So Earthbound is a book that I co-wrote with my friend Genevieve Turner. And it's the second full-length book in a series that we've been writing just set during like an alternate version of like the 60s space race. So we want it to feel like realistic, but it's not like it's not NASA, right? So like it's like a fictionalized version of it. And it was funny because Parsons is the antagonist in the first full-length book in the series, which is called Stardust. And he is like the head of engineering for the American Space Department, which is like our fake NASA. And he like forces the black moment in that moment in that book. He forces the hero to like disavow the heroine and like he creates all this stress and tension and drama. And Genevieve was like, he needs to be the next hero. And I was like, no, like, that's a terrible idea. I was like so opposed to it. And she was like, no, just trust me. I'm going to write some scenes. I'm going to send them to you. You're going to see. And she wrote a scene, which is the teaser scene at the end of Stardust, where he leaves the party after this first mission has gone well. And he shows up in this hotel room and there's this woman there and they're like having this steamy affair and it does not identify who it is. Jen was totally right. I loved the scene. And so we ended up writing the book. And when Stardust came out, I have never gotten as many emails from readers as I did about that scene. And everyone was like, oh my God, like who is the woman with Parsons? And I was like, holy shit, like this is going to work. Like people are going to accept this like super controlling engineer, like super buttoned down, like pocket protector guy, like as a romance hero. I was absolutely stunned. So the heroine, the woman in the hotel room, will blow the secret now, is a computer engineer. And so the book starts in 1961 when he hires her. And I know like that's kind of a complicated dynamic for people, but he's not her like direct boss, I should say. And so she is this brilliant computer scientist and he is the director of engineering. And they are both incredibly devoted to their work and really, really cerebral. And they also both feel kind of out of place in a lot of situations in a lot of places. Her, Charlie, because she is like this woman in engineering at a time when that's a little unusual. And then him, because even though he's really, really dedicated to the mission, which is like great in some ways, is also kind of alienating for people in some ways. And so they begin this sort of secret affair after they've known each other, 6 months, 10 months or something. And the sort of rules of it are like, we don't talk about it at work. Like when we're together, like it's just sex, no like messy feelings. And of course, like that is not going to work out, right? They're in a romance novel. Sorry, guys. Like, unfortunately, that's going out the window. So they embark on the secret affair, and that's the basic setup for the book. And then, of course, that you know gets complicated. So that's what Earthbound is about.
And he's not just like buttoned up and very professional and whatever. I think one of my favorite things about him is that he just like has people's backs, even some people who don't even know that he's like his secretary, I remember, is like mm-hmm. terrified of him because of the way he just operates and feels like he's like yelling at her all the time. And like he recognizes that she would probably be a better fit for someone else, but that she needs, I can't remember her exact circumstances, but she needs the money. Like her husband is out of work or something.
Yeah. And he's worried that like the other men might sexually harass her or like make her life like difficult in these other ways. And even with like Charlie, like there's a scene where one of the astronauts is sort of hitting on her and like Parsons like goes and checks in with her afterward and is like, are you okay? Like, should I say something to him? So like on the one hand, he's very gruff and can be legitimately an asshole. But on the other hand, like it's part of a management strategy that actually like you can kind of see how he rationalizes it and like why he thinks he needs to operate the way he
I'm
does.
Kind of amazed that you didn't think the gruff buttoned up asshole would appeal to romance readers because that is absolutely my catnip. I love the buttoned up ones that snap and are all secretly hot and noble.
Sure, but I think I was worried that like people would accept it from an astronaut, but might not accept it from an engineer. So like, I absolutely agree with you. And I was actually in this interesting email exchange with my friend, Olivia Dade, the writer Olivia Dade the other day about whether we thought grumpy heroes that we see today, because grumpy, it feels like grumpy and fake relationship are like the themes of this year, which are great themes. Like I'm a favorite of those themes, but, I was suggesting that maybe today's grumpy hero is actually like a more socially acceptable version of the kind of like punishing kiss 80s, 90s hero. Like, that's clearly, like, unacceptable now. Like, people are not going to go for that. Uh-huh. But maybe that's, like, the grumpy hero is, like, transformed into, maybe he's, like, an evolved version.
Wow, you just said the punishing kiss hero, and, like, I've immediately flashed back to the hundreds of books I've read, I feel like, with punishing kisses. Why are they always punishing?
Yeah.
I remember there was, I forget which one I read, but it was like every single kissing scene for like until they, you know, two thirds of the way through the book, every single kiss was punishing. And I was like, can't you just like softly make out? Like, it doesn't have to bruise your lips every time. And also, that's probably a bad sign.
Yeah. I mean, so in my romance reading, like I'm not going to read any romances. Holy shit. I love romances. Like I went back and read like 80s romances. And when I read Whitney, My Love, the back of my head almost blew off. Like that may be the book with all the punishing kisses, because it's really, it's like the sexuality becomes a way to like control the heroine.
Doesn't the hero rape her in that one? Like I can't read that one because it starts with that and then it romances. And I know it was like a huge, I don't know, awakening for many people who read that as one of their first romances, but like, I refuse to pick it up because that's irredeemable for me. There's no way I could ever root for that.
I support that choice to not read the book because I understand what purpose the scene served in. I think that's in 85. I think 85 is the publication date on that book. But yeah, I mean, it's really tough to read, and there's a revision of it. And I taught a class on romance novels. Like this is how intense like my interest in the subject became. For that scene, I pulled the revised version and then the original version. And we had this interesting debate in class about whether or not we thought the revision fixed the issue or not. And one of the interesting things in the revision is the word rape now appears in the text.
Oh.
And I think that makes it worse because then it's like actually, like there's no way to like try and divorce it from like a legalistic context. Like the once you name it, I think it's even harder to kind of justify it.
I am fascinated all of a sudden realizing, like you're saying you taught a class on romance novels, and I know your twins are seven, and you read your first romance novel when you were nursing them. So in a span of seven years, you've gone from like, oh, that's interesting, I should read one just to like complete my academic knowledge of this subject, to writing a slew of them and teaching them. Like that's a quick turnaround.
It's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. No, I mean, it really was. It fit a lot. Like my research interests were American popular literature and in the 19th century, so in like a historical way. But it felt like a very like natural outgrowth of that. And it was actually easier to pitch a class on romance novels than on like 18th century popular culture. Okay. Like, so it all just kind of worked out in a random way.
Do you think the academia focus on publisher parish helped you churn out so many books in such a short time? Because there's like five in your Fly Me to the Moon series and like three in your political series. And then you've got some other things. And that's a lot considering you just started reading it 7 years ago.
Well, I think not wanting to write my dissertation.
oh my God. Like grad students will do anything to avoid. It's like, I will become a best-selling really author just to avoid finishing my dissertation.
Well, I'm definitely not a best-seller.
Well, not yet.
I missed that mark. But no, I actually know a lot of people who wrote secret novels while not writing their dissertation. I think it's actually like a really common coping mechanism because like, you know, it's like butt in the chair and you know that you need to write. And so you're like trying to be really disciplined. But sometimes you just can't work on chapter three of this dissertation. And so like the next thing you know, you've written 20,000 words of this other, you know, project. I call it productive procrastination. Like I'm not doing what I actually should be doing, but I'm actually getting something else done. And it's the worst because it's so seductive. Because you're like, I did do things. They just aren't the right things.
I think there's got to be some kind of crossover where you can write a dissertation and then make it part of the narrative so that there's sex scenes in it, you know?
Wouldn't that be like that Laura Willig series, right? The Secret of the Pink Carnation? I feel like that's
I haven't read that.
Okay, well, right after this, you need to go and read that. It's like one of the things that happened was when I started reading romance, I realized that I had been reading for romance like my whole life. Like all of these books that I loved when I was kids are really, when I was a child, are really romances. And one of those was The Scarlet Pimpernel, the Baroness Orczy novel. And I think it's now like a musical as well. But I adored that book as a child. I must have read it like 150 times. And this it's basically that idea. So it's like during the French Revolution, like this society that's helping get people like out of France so that they won't like face the guillotine. And so that's like one strand of it. And the other strand is this American woman who's gone to England to write a dissertation on that group. And so it's like, she's doing research and there's a romance that flows through the contemporary strand. And then every book has a romance in the historical.
Oh,
strand.
Okay. I'm going to read that. That sounds great.
They really
this isn't quite
good.
The same, but when I was in grad school, I was taking a funerary archaeology course and we were talking about bog bodies, and a lot of bog bodies were like tied up and clearly had been executed and like shoved in the bog. Yeah. And so I started writing this fake academic article about how all the bog bodies are evidence of like past BDSM. And it was all just, accidents during these like wild orgies. And like, this wasn't what I was supposed to be doing. But I don't know.
It sounds hilarious.
I never did it. My plan was eventually to write it and do the citations and make it look as much like a scholarly article as I could, and then like put it in the professor's mailbox and then just never mention it and not sign my name.
Oh my
and this is a new piece of scholarship. Well, I mean, obviously he wouldn't believe it, but I don't know. Maybe I can still do that.
You should. Oh my gosh, you totally should. Academic humor.
Yeah, I'm trying to breathe over here over Sarah's BDSM bog bodies, but okay. So I just read the most recent book in that, and it's the Fly Me to the Moon series. I'm terrible with titles, clearly.
Yeah, it's okay.
So Free Fall is the latest one, and in Free Fall we get it's a very different book from Earthbound, at least. So I'm going to let you tell us because I'm just going to start babbling. So I'll babble once you've told us what it's about.
Okay. So I would say the series is divided between books that are like heavier and like angstier and then books that are like lighter. And Free Fall is like total cotton candy book. Very, very much so. And so Genevieve and I, when we were like plotting the series, which was 4 years ago, I can't believe it's been that long, but one of us was like, Astronaut Marriage of Convenience. And we were like, oh, yes, we have to write Astronaut Marriage of Convenience. And so that was sort of the genesis of like, how could we make that work? Like, how would a Marriage of Convenience book work in the 1960s, right? And so we decided like maybe an unintended pregnancy might be a good setup for that. And like 65 is about as late as you could pitch an unintended pregnancy book without like running into Roe versus Wade and other things, right? We also wanted to write this book about the invention of the spacesuit or the development of the spacesuit. And so those two ideas sort of came together. So essentially the setup for the book is that the heroine, Vivi, is she's young. She's 19. She's a college student. She's gone to this party with her dad, who's a defense contractor, and sort of gotten bored and wandered outside. And she meets this astronaut and they sort of have this flirtation and she goes home with him. And then at the same time, across the country in Cape Canaveral, there is an accident when they are testing the spacesuit that her dad builds. And so as a result of that accident, which injures this other astronaut, the directive goes out that everybody's got to really buckle down. Parsons, of course, like issuing this rule. And he's like, everyone's got to buckle down. No drinking, no hard driving, and no sex. And then, you know, key up 2 months later, Vivi is pregnant from the one night that she spent with Dean, the hero. And so to sort of make it all right, they get married. They do not know each other at all. And so that's the sort of setup. And I think it's a really funny book. We started writing it right before the 2016 election, and trying not to talk about politics, but we were really stressed out. And we wrote 30,000 words of the book in a week. And it was like all of these just like set piece funny scenes. And we had no real plot. We're just like, wouldn't it be funny if the astronauts have this squash league and like this engineer like kicks Dean's ass? And we were like, wouldn't it be funny if like Vivi does this? And so a lot of the scenes were really just us coming up with funny scenarios because we were stressed out and just like needed some kind of distraction from what was happening. And then like the election happened and we could not go back to the book because it just felt like this book from another world. And so it was just sitting there for the longest time. And finally we're like, we have to finish it. And luckily I think enough time had passed that we could go back and sort of get the cotton candiness of that book sort of back into that headspace.
And it does. I feel like it's such a, it's a good like palate cleanser book. Like if you are like, you've just read something really deep and dark and heavy and need to like pull yourself back out of that hole, this would be a good book to jump over to. And it's funny, mm-hmm. I hate the surprise baby trope. I do not like babies or pregnancy in romance novels at all. Like, I normally will not touch a book, but because you had written it, I was like, all right, I'm gonna do this. And I really enjoyed it here. And I think I wanted, Sarah and I haven't even discussed it. I hate it so much that we've never covered it. Sarah's not into it either. And like,
it's okay. I totally understand. It's not my favorite either,
Say. No, but it totally works here. So now I'm like, why do I hate it? Why do people like it? And am I just like not giving it enough credit? And I think I'm surprised. So we interviewed Kat Sebastian last year.
I love
She's
Kat.
Fantastic. And she had twins as well. She's another twin mom. Mm-hmm. And she says like she can't go near the surprise baby trope. Like it sends her into a spiral of like, oh God, I'm going to get pregnant again. So I think I was sort of surprised. Like you obviously don't feel that way because you wrote one.
If we'd been able to figure out another way to make the marriage of convenience work without the pregnancy, we would not have written it that way. Like, cause it's not my favorite trope either. And I had like a difficult, scary pregnancy. And so like in part, that's often like part of the drama later on is like some kind of difficulty with that. And I absolutely cannot read like pregnancy drama in a book like that, even something I'm enjoying, I'll put it down at that point. So I made Jen promise that we would not do it that way, but we couldn't think of another reason to have a marriage of convenience in the 1960s other than accidental pregnancy. And even then, like her dad had to be like powerful enough to kind of force the marriage. And so like, it was mainly like our commitment to that trope that made us have to plot the book, because otherwise I think we would have abandoned.
That's a really good point.
It's not my favorite.
And that is a good point. It doesn't fall into like the territory that I think a lot of the surprise baby or the pregnancy tropes do. It's, you know, it's a plot point and it's relevant and it they do explore it, but yeah, you don't have like the drama surrounding it. It just is something that causes them to get married.
Yeah. At least that was our hope in setting it up. So if people are worried about it for that reason, I hope at least that we haven't set off any of those kind of triggers.
I remember reading a surprise pregnancy book. Larissa Ione has the Four Horsemen series, which is like this really intense post-apocalyptic, like supernatural series. And the Horseman mm-hmm. Death, I was really looking forward to his story. And when his story opens, his significant other is 8 months pregnant. And you spend the entire mm-hmm. book with her 8 months pregnant, like trying to outrace demons. And I was like, this is awful. Like, this sounds like a nightmare. To me, it's more like I haven't experienced it firsthand. I've just heard the horror stories and like I've been actively trying mm-hmm. to avoid it for my entire adult life. So I'm like, I don't want this in my escapist fantasy.
Yeah. I think it's very triggering for a lot of people, whether they have been pregnant or not been pregnant. Like, I think it just like opens up this can of worms, and it's just hard to put that into a romance because I do think it interferes with the fantasy.
But I think that's partly why I've brought it up here as like, I normally hate this. Oh, there's the dog. Yay. We got the dog.
Yeah.
Is to like reassure people if they go and look at this and go, oh, pregnancy, I'm not touching that. Like it does not fall into that category at all. It's a really good read and does not, at least for me, doesn't trigger any of that stuff. And I'm still nursing a 5 month old. So like I'm deep in the bowels of that at the moment.
Motherhood, man, it never lets you go. I'm just so glad the book worked for you. That's fantastic.
I have a question about, so you're talking about your experience in popular literature and the things you teach. Mm-hmm. Where do you get this science background to write these things?
Well, I am not the scientist, and that's where the co-writing thing came in. So, because Genevieve does have a PhD in neuroscience, and we're both married to physicists or engineers. And so it's kind of like so for me, it's not a part of my life at all, but kind of surrounding. And so when I had the idea to write an astronaut romance, Jen was my critique partner at that point. So I sent her this email and I was like, what do you think about like an astronaut series? And she was like, oh my God, you have to do that. Like, stop what else you're working on. Write that for me right now. I want to read it. So I started like poking around in NASA history stuff. And I was like, this is really technical. Like, I don't understand this crap. And then I was like, Jen, maybe we should write it together. And that was sort of where the genesis of it came in. And it's interesting. Like, NASA has like the most generous online archives of like any government agency or organization that I have ever seen. Like, you can read like the minutes of every single of those like classic 60s missions. Like, thousands of pages of like everything that was said back and forth between Houston and the capsule on Apollo 11 or something. And there's just like just this voluminous amount of material. And some of it is very approachable and some of it, you know, wouldn't probably make sense to even a sort of hyper specialist. But I think working through it with her and having like her technical expertise and like our husbands both proofread Earthbound because we wanted to make sure that the details were, I mean, I'm sure there are things we got wrong, but we wanted the details to feel authentic, even if I'm sure, again, there are imperfections.
Had your husbands read romance novels before?
My husband has read a handful. So every once in a while, he's not a big reader, but he does travel a lot. And so sometimes I'll be like, I put something on your iPad that I think they'll really like. So like he read a couple of Jennifer Cruzies
oh, yeah.
and liked those. And so like there's like a few that I've talked him into reading. And his note on Earthbound, she's like, this is a really good book, but there's like too much sex.
What?
Sweetie Pie, like... Never. I was like, babe, like, I'll take your technical notes. Like, tell me what I got wrong about, like, orbital mechanics. But
wait,
no, babe. Like, that is not a problem.
He thought there was too much sex?
He thought there was too much sex. He was like, I think you need to get a sex scene or two. I was like,
absolutely
no.
Absolutely not. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
No, my boyfriend loves proofreading my sex scenes. He's like, this is great. I can't remember if I told the story before where he tried to write a sex scene. I don't know if I told this on the podcast. He was, like, reading a sex scene. He was like, I bet I could do one. And then, like, 6 hours later, he's like, okay, this is as far as I got. And like, they didn't even get to the meet cute. He like couldn't just write a sex scene without them like feeling like strong emotions for each other and like falling in love. And so it's like a page and a half of this guy like gazing at this woman at the opera. And I was like, what are you doing?
That's adorable.
So
actually,
I got him into romance with Wanted and Wired. And now I think I'm going to give him The Hating Game next. I think he'd be really into it. And we're going to slowly... Mm-hmm. Jenny still needs to get her husband into romance.
My husband only reads nonfiction. And mm-hmm. like really dry nonfiction too. And I think when we... I got him to read The Alchemist. Like when we first got together. Mm-hmm. But that's like this big. I'm holding up very small fingers. And not even really fiction. It's more like mythology or something. I don't know. But yeah.
You should write a construction series and then force him to proofread for you.
Oh, that's a good call. I mean, he would read it if I asked him to, I think. But yeah, he's very into like business and tech and yeah, like those really dry, terrifying books. Okay, random question. Do you picture Parsons as anyone, like a figure that we would know?
Oh, yeah. No, Parsons in our head, very, very... directly. And like, we have literally like this incredibly big, Pinterest board dedicated to Oscar Isaac. So Parsons in our head is Oscar Isaac. And it's funny because neither Jen nor I particularly Jen, it's not somebody like develops celebrity crushes, but Oscar Isaac like overrules all rules of like physics or like anything. So yeah, Parsons is Oscar Isaac.
I kind of wish I had known that when I'm going to have to go back and reread it with him in mind because that is so perfect now that you say it, but was not who I was picturing.
Who are you picturing?
That's why I asked because I wasn't, I wasn't picturing anyone, but I did you see Brie posting the Keanu Reeves like oral sex gifts?
Yes.
And so like that made me made me see Keanu Reeves in a whole new light. And obviously Keanu Reeves is not Parsons, but then I was like, wait, who is Parsons? Because I'd been reading Free Fall at the time. So yeah, that's Oscar Isaacs. I like it. That's perfect. Okay, so a question about your books in general. I feel like there's something that comes up a fair bit, and it's like people knowing how to play the assumptions that other people are going to make about them and to like use that to their advantage. So we get Charlie knows that she's an attractive woman, and instead of trying to like nerd herself down and, you know, not play to that, she's always got her perfect lipstick on and she's dressed properly and looks good and uses that to her advantage. Or Dean in Free Fall kind of plays the cowboy. He like plays the dumb astronaut to like make people underestimate him and then uses that to strategically get the advantage. Where does that come from? Because I see it with your characters a fair bit. Is that something you do?
Yes, I think my inner monologue is at least 10% me reminding myself how to human. Like, which is probably like a terrifying like thing to admit, but I'm just like super socially awkward. And I was at this event yesterday where I had to like mingle with people, and it was like the worst hell in the entire world. And trying to like remind myself how to be with people, I think is part of that. Cause I'm just like very much kind of an academic stereotype, very introverted, very awkward. Then like you have to deconstruct everything afterward, right? Like, oh my God, did that interaction go the way that I thought that it should have? And could I have fixed that? And so I think that does come out of my inner monologue in a big way.
That makes perfect sense. Just that like very self-aware, like you know what those assumptions are, but, and are like kind of trying to control them. And that's coming out through your characters. That's interesting.
Yeah. I had an advisor at one point, he was talking about teaching, and he was saying like, you always perform, like teaching is like a performance of self, and that you have to make like choices about you and like how you present yourself. And like, I'm super duper short and like look a little bit younger than I am. And so I'm like, it's really important to like project the right thing in the classroom, because otherwise I can lose authority of my students. Right. And so like, I think I'm aware of that for that reason. Cause people are like, oh, she's like, yeah. So I'm aware of it because it's something I feel like I often have to overcome in a professional context.
Yeah. That's what the characters are doing as well. So I'm trying to decide which direction to go next. You've made the note, I should warn you that Free Fall is a turning point in the series and that you're moving into the back half of the stories you want to tell. What does that mean? Where are we headed in the series?
Well, I mean, 65 is kind of like, you know, it's a year in real life in 65, like NASA looked like they were behind in the space race. Like it really looked like the Soviets were going to beat the US to the moon, right? Like they actually had a spacewalk first, and like they had not had as many accidents or as many problems, but just also like socially, like the early part of the 60s is really like the 50s, right? Like not that much is changing, but by 65, like Vietnam is heating up, and Genevieve and I currently have a big debate about what year exactly the next book will be set in. So like, I'm not going to say, cause we don't know yet, but like 68 is obviously like maybe the most consequential year in American history. And so like all this stuff is going to happen, whether it happens on the page or whether it just like influences the action in a different way. You know, we're sort of moving into a darker period. You know, it's not like fluffy dresses and jello molds anymore. Not that that was all that like 1961 was, because like obviously there's a lot of complication and undercurrent then too, but like we're moving into an even more kind of unsettled period. So I suspect that the next two books will be much like darker, angstier, much more like Earthbound or A Midnight Feast, which was this Marriage in Trouble novella that we wrote, which is very, very dark, and not as much like Free Fall or Stardust or the Round Midnight novellas, which are much like lighter and fluffier and optimistic.
It's really interesting. So you've got this series, and then you have a like political AIDS series. And Sarah and I were laughing just before we started the interview, saying that like it's a really complicated time for you to be writing both of these stories, because in the space series, we've got competition with the Soviets, and it sounds mm-hmm. like the next book might have even more Soviet content to it.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's very fair to say. Like, we're going to dive into the Russian stuff in a big way.
And then your political aides, it's like, you know, Republicans and Democrats you could kind of throw that around casually in like 2015, and now it feels very different.
Yes. And like in 2015, I was saying things like, I'm going to write political romance forever. And now it's like, oh, wait, maybe that's not a good idea. And there were plenty of people who did not want to read like that series when it was coming out in 2014, 2015. And like with the Rogue series, these sort of anthologies I've done a couple of shorts for, like I know there's lots of people now who don't want to read it. But wow, it makes way more sense to me in 2018 why someone would be like, no, I don't want to read anything set in the political realm. Whereas like in 2014, 2015, I was like, well, okay, I mean, I get it, but like, I think it's a really interesting world. And now I'm like, oh no, I get it. I get why people wouldn't want to read it. Like, yeah.
Are you done with that series then?
I think at least for moment.
For, you know, an unspecified amount of time, maybe a couple more years.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how fast it goes. It was really funny because with Free Fall, Vivi's last name is Muller, and we had named her again in 2016. Like I was like way long before any of this had happened, and like we had like a bunch of reasons, like in terms of her family history of like why we thought they needed to have a German last name and blah, blah, blah. But it was so, there were all of these typos in the manuscript where Robert Mueller's name has two E's in it and hers only has one E. But there were all of these like mistaken Mullers in the second half of the book that we had to go in and fix. It was really funny.
Yeah, we were talking, just going back to the politics really quickly, the party lines is sort of this enemies to lovers, Republican and Democrat, and trying to decide, like, reading it today, like, but Jenny and I both want to give it a go because we love enemies to lovers, and that's so interesting. And it is just kind of fascinating how the real world can shape your, I'm struggling to articulate myself right now. It's just interesting how something like the current political situation changes the way I feel about escapist literature. Like, I've been embracing escapist literature, like, all over. I'm reading so many romance novels. I'm reading so much fantasy. Mm-hmm. I'm avoiding things that I know are going to make me sad. And it is just interesting being like, how am I going to feel when here's this thing that I use as my escapism and then has these sort of echoes with modern day politics, and will that affect how I see it? So actually, I'm going to read it just as an experiment.
Okay, well, let me read how it goes. I almost never reread my books, but on election night, I had actually picked that book up, and I was, because it's set like during like the course of a presidential election. And I should say, like, it's my favorite book that I've written, and like, and I really love that book, but it's become really hard to recommend it because I know it's really complicated. But I was reading it on election night. It was like, man, like, finish in the morning, it'd be great. I'll feel like all optimistic and happy, and that was not how it worked out. But yeah, it's, I completely get it. And for me, like, when I started writing that series, which was like in 2013, and like the first book was like my nano novel in 2013, maybe even 2012, I don't know, it's been a long time, but whatever it was, the first two books are not particularly partisan. It's like in the first book in that series, they're both Democrats. And like the second book, like, their party politics don't really come up at all. Like, it's just really about like the world of DC and influence and money. But for me, like, politics is a place where a lot of people actually are choosing hope and like choosing life in a way. Like, it has this terrible reputation, like DC does, like, you know, it's all these like ambitious aides, like walking around, like shoving their business cards in everyone's hand. Like, that's the kind of reputation that the city has. And I, you know, when I moved out, like right after college, this terrible stereotype, and I was really worried about that. But what I found was a city full of people who were like incredibly optimistic about their ability to create change in the world in a way that was super inspiring. And that was what was interesting to me about writing romances set in that world, was just like, here are all these people who genuinely want to change the world for the better, like genuinely want to improve the world. And wouldn't it be cool to also have them, I guess, in some cases not achieving that, but in some cases also like finding love at the same time.
Do you still, have you managed to hold on to that optimism?
It's been tough. And I would say, like, part of why I don't work in politics anymore, and I don't, is that it was hard to maintain even for a short period of time. Like, how do you keep running into the wall and like get up again? You know, that's really hard. And I would say, like, the last 2 years, I really want to believe that like institutions are really strong and like, can overcome things, but I'm definitely, I think, a little bit more cynical now than I was like 2.5 years ago, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all are. You haven't really had a choice, but I'm clinging to the hope that there are still optimists out there and we can turn it around.
Yeah, I've actually really liked seeing what's happened to writing and the stories that are getting told and the way people are addressing issues like consent and like female anger and like all of these things. I feel like people kind of ran out of fucks to give. Like, we're all, that's okay. We like the dog.
It's the dog.
But it's sort of a, one of my friends who has been working on a novel for a while, took a few years off.
I just closed the door. Hopefully he's not here anymore. I apologize.
But he hadn't written for a long time. And after the election, he started writing again because he was like, you know what? Life's too short not to pursue the things that give you joy. And I feel like a lot of people are like, you know what? Like, I'm angry and I feel like I can't affect things on a large scale, but I'm going to try anyway. And in the meantime, I'm going to tell the story I want to tell, and I'm going to stop censoring myself, and I'm going to address these difficult things. And I've actually really liked seeing how people's art has been changing in like daring and exciting and often optimistic ways. So it's...
Yeah. And I absolutely think that, that's true. And it is interesting the way that the advice has gone from like, don't be political on Twitter. I mean, like that was absolutely just the dominant message I felt like in 2014, 2015 to, oh my God, how can you not be political on Twitter? And I mean, one of the drums that I've been beating for a long time as a writer is just that like all books are political and like the specifically all romances are political. And that when we act like, you know, a regency, a Tonset regency, like such a traditional regency, when we act like that's not a political book, it does a lot of damage to the landscape because then a book like, say, like one of Kat Sebastian's regencies or like K.J. Charles' A Seditious Affair, right, which are like very, very much engaged like in a very overt way with the politics of the time. And when we say that that first book, that traditional regency, isn't political, then we can just act like it's just escapism. It makes it really, really hard to market something that is more overtly political when really like, that book about that Duke is super political too. Like, where did his money come from and how does he maintain his power? And like, you know, even things like where do her clothes come from? That Muslim, right? Like it's printed, it's from India. Like, in what conditions was it produced? It's blah, 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 blah. I mean, so like, but even narrative choices, like, do you write that book in first person or third person point of view? That's a political choice, right? And so I think I've been really heartened by the fact that people are more overt about that political stuff today than I feel like they were, you know, a few years
ago. And maybe that's a positive change we can focus on that's come out of all of this is it's like forced us to own up to some things like that and really embrace it. And like, I think has opened a lot of people's eyes to things like privilege in those novels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that by ignoring the political elements, we're enforcing that privilege and that we have to address it. So maybe we'll cling to that. But I loved the other day you went and assigned Hogwarts House to all of the characters in your books. And that was part of what Sarah and I were like, all right, where would we go next if we were going to read one of like just a straight Emma Barry novel? And we saw that Enemy Lines is Slytherin. And we were like, all right, secret forbidden affair, Slytherin, let's do this. was that, I'm assuming that was kind of a fun exercise.
It was. And it came out of this idea from a Smart Bitches Trashy Books post where somebody had asked for Slytherin Hufflepuff pairings, which is not, I'm not sure I've ever really written one of those. But I thought it was absolutely, utterly brilliant. And I think we should start talking about like all romances that way because I think the language we have to talk about characters and like we often categorize heroes that way, or not in the Hogwarts sense, but in like alpha, beta, caretaking alpha. And we have a much more limited vocabulary to talk about heroines. I mean, you have terms like prickly or likable, which are often like really gendered and like really sexist, but they're also just not like super descriptive. And even more recent developments like cinnamon roll hero, people don't always seem to agree on what they mean. And so I love the Hogwarts House test because I think people do kind of instinctively, or at least people who are immersed in American popular culture, right? Western popular culture do sort of instinctively have a sense of what those houses mean. And it also gives us a way to talk about both heroes and heroines, assuming straight romance, of course. But you could do the same thing for queer romance or poly romance. It gives us this really like descriptive language to talk about both of the characters or all of the characters. And I just loved that idea.
And when I was going through, I was like, yeah, of course Parsons is a Slytherin and Charlie is a Ravenclaw. And like Dean is clearly a Gryffindor and Vivi is obviously a Hufflepuff and it makes you think about them just in those terms and about those attributes that they bring to the character.
Yeah. And there was like some debate in the comments on the Smart Bitches post where, and I think some authors even stepped in and said, hey, like, I'm not sure that character is a Hufflepuff. I think it's actually a Gryffindor. And so then it like leads to this really productive conversation, I feel like, about characterization. So even when there's not agreement, I felt like the conversation was still like really cool and interesting.
Yeah, that's funny when your readers have kind of gotten a different sense of your character and you know them so well as the author and you're like, no, they're not. And they're like, yeah, but no, that's a Hufflepuff.
But then it's like, is that like a death of the author moment? Like if the author feels like the character, like why would we defer to the author's decision about where the character should be? So that's like also an interesting like academic question.
Yeah, like you don't own the character anymore because they are who you've put on the page and who they're coming across as. And or it kind of reminds me of like, it's one of our rapid fire questions, spoiler alert, we're going to ask you later what house you're in. Okay. And so often people say, well, I test as, you know, Slytherin or whatever it is, but I feel like I'm Gryffindor. And it's probably that for the characters, like the, you know, they're testing as one, but the author feels like there's something different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in choice, right? I mean, that's the big Harry Potter theme. Like, which house would they choose if they had to, you know, the hat thought? So I don't know. That comes into play too.
And then I like you, you have things like a Huffleclaw or whatever, where people are like, this doesn't express the entirety of my existence. How many hyphens can I add in here? but it is interesting how much people identify with just four basic personality types. But I guess it's the same with like Myers-Briggs is 16 and people were like, yes, this is me. This is me entirely. So,
yeah. That's a really good point. I do think it's a little easier than Myers-Briggs because that would be like a lot of decisions to have to make about your characters.
That's true. That's true. Do you know your Myers-Briggs type?
Yeah, I'm an INTJ and like I feel like that is fairly descriptive for me and fairly accurate.
I'm an INFP, but I've learned how to be functional in the real world, so. It's supposed to be like, you daydream and can't get anything done. And I'm like, well, I daydream, but like, you have to function in some way. I don't know. I think Jenny's looking herself up or something.
I have it saved and I can't ever remember the letters, which is why we don't use it, right? Like, you know yours, but then when I'll find it. But anyway.
Okay.
I feel like you're like an INFJ or something, or an INTJ. I don't know.
I actually don't. I test extrovert.
Oh.
So I'm the one where it's like, this is what dictators are. Like I remember it saying that. That's why I want to find it, because it was hilarious what the like assessment of it was. And yeah, but anyway, it's going to take me forever to find it in my email. So we should move on. Oh, and
you're the ENTJ, I think.
ENTJ, the commander. That's it. Where it's like, you might be kind of terrifying.
That's much
like,
better than dictator.
Please, please use your power for good. Which is, so that's where I fall. But anyway, and Slytherin, I think, is probably a good way of looking at that too. But well, I think we are actually at the point in the interview where we should jump over and start asking you rapid fire questions, speaking of them. So the first question is, what is the most interesting or strangest object that's in your workspace?
Oh, that's a great question. Looking at the bookcase, there is a brick. So I used to work for Senator, and there's a brick that a constituent sent him in the mail. And it was like a parting gift when I left the office. And it's sitting on my bookcase.
We need to unpack that a bit. Sarah and I are looking at each other like, what the fuck? People mail senators bricks? Like, is it supposed to be like a brick through the window kind of, but more polite?
It's about building a wall on the southern U.S.
Oh.
And to me, I am certainly not in favor of that. So it was kind of ironic. It is an ironic brick.
But the person who sent it, was it clear, like, was this their contribution to the wall of like, here is a brick, you can build a wall? Or
I think it's like an encouragement, like, here's what you should be thinking. But I think it also has that like aggressive overtone, like you mentioned, sort of like the brick through the window.
I was really enjoying my fantasy of someone who's like lawful good, like wanting to throw a brick through a window and being like, I can't, so I'm going to mail it. Like some disgruntled Hufflepuff. Like, okay. that's much more disappointing that they're like, here's the first brick. that's cool though. That's a cool thing to have in your office.
It's very random.
Is there anything you irrationally hate?
Bananas. I hate bananas. Like, they're never right. Right? They're either like too hard, or like then you leave the room and like suddenly they're too soft, and then they're like brown, and I'm like, oh, I should make banana bread, but I hate bananas. But then I like feel bad throwing them away, and so I kind of have to go.
Why have you been buying bananas if you hate them so much?
My kids like them, right? And so, and then like you, like they come in a big bunch, and so like the kids, it'll be like the right softness or whatever. And the kids will eat like four, and then there's like four more bananas, and then I throw them away, and it like annoys me that no one ate them. So I guess I'm also annoyed at my family.
You irrationally hate your family's love of bananas.
Yes, that's it. I don't irrationally hate the family, just the fact they make me buy bananas and then don't eat them, and then I feel bad discarding them.
I feel like you could put threatening notes on them. I think I saw somewhere that if you scratch the peel of a banana as it browns, like the note will come out, and you can just, Yeah, ooh, just creepy. Like harass your kids and make them think that there's like a vengeful ghost in your house.
Then they'll eat all the bananas.
Or never eat a banana again.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, this might go exactly.
Yeah, the banana
way.
Says eat me, or like I guess that got inappropriate, but like, yeah, I'm watching you. Yeah, it was Sarah McLean who posted that and I was like, you're a monster. I'm never gonna trust bananas again. Because apparently people were doing it in the grocery store.
Oh no, that's so.
So like
crazy.
You do it, and then people get their banana home, and there's a message on it, and it's like, oh, that's.
Wouldn't you feel like an idiot though, like standing there in the grocery store with this like stick pen, like scratching on a banana? Like, wouldn't that disturb people?
Yes, but if you're the kind of person who wants to do that, then maybe you're the kind of person who's not worried about it. I don't know. Anyway, next question. The zombie apocalypse is happening and you can only save one work of fiction that you didn't write.
Okay, is it a work of fiction for me to like read during the zombie apocalypse or am I saving it for like future?
That is your choice to make.
Oh no. This is like an unfair question.
Yes, it is.
Okay, well, if I'm saving it for like future humanity, or I guess if I'm only going to read this one book over and over again forever, I'm going to go with Susanna Kearsley's The Winter Sea, which have you read any Kearsley?
Yes. Yes, that's that
okay.
One. It's okay, really good.
Excellent. I adore that book. And it's like my classic, like if somebody is like maybe saying they want to try a romance, I mean, obviously, always try to tailor it to the person, but that's like the one that I've given more than any other. It's kind of strong romantic elements, and there's like a sort of paranormal-y piece, but like I really love the way that it's written, and so I'm going to go with The Winter Sea.
I think that's a good way of approaching it, and that's, I feel like you should save something that you want to read over and over again that's escapism, even if it's not for you, if it's for humanity, because there's fucking zombies, and it should just be like a good book. People who try to save like the works of Shakespeare or whatever, I'm like, yeah, okay, but like, do I really want to read it over and over again when there's zombies pounding on the door? Like, yeah.
Probably not. Yeah.
Okay. When you're not writing, what do you most like to read?
Oh, I'm a voracious reader. And so I read all around fiction, nonfiction. The only thing I don't read is gory mystery. Sometimes I'll read like a sort of cozy mystery or like sort of classic golden age British mystery, but nothing that's scary or nothing where there's like really gruesome crime. This year has been a weird reading year for me because I've read a bunch of fantasy, which is not typically a thing that I've been reading. So it's been like this weird mix of like political nonfiction and like fantasy and
Wait,
romance.
What fantasy have you read?
I think probably the best read of the year has been Megan Whalen Turner's The Queen's Thief series.
I haven't read that.
Oh my gosh, they're so good. And I sort of accidentally started with book two. Like I thought I was starting with book one. And so book two is called The Queen of Atolia. And then book one reads much like YA. Like it was that first book is a YA book, but the rest of the series reads more like adult fantasy. And there is a very subtle romance in it, which I would not for like the world ruin for you. But there's like a really satisfying romance arc that sort of plays out over the books. And the sixth and final book is going to come out next
week. Okay. I normally read romance and fantasy, but I really, really want to read Jane Doe by Victoria Stone, who also writes Victoria Doll. Because have you read it, Jenny?
Okay. So I'm not going to read it because and I think it probably falls in the category of stuff you wouldn't like as well, Emma. And like, I really don't like Jessica Jones, the TV show. It's just, I don't know. I'm fine with violence up to a point, but there's like this territory of violence and gore that I just like, So I was reading, there were a few people's reactions to it on Twitter where they were saying they didn't like it for the same reasons that they don't like Jessica Jones, where it's just like too much and like they get why people like it. So yeah, I think I'm probably going to stay away from it, but you can read it and tell us, Sarah.
Yeah. I just know it's like the ultimate feminist revenge fantasy is what everyone's telling me. And I'm like, that's what I want. I want to like read something and be like, fuck yeah, get him. That's what I want in life.
That makes sense. Just let us know if it's too like gory.
Okay,
or
I will, because I normally don't read super gory stuff either, and like I get scared pretty easily. So maybe this will be a horrible mistake, but I'll let you know.
Okay.
It's me. Okay. Would you rather be forgotten or hatefully remembered?
Oh no, this is a terrible one too. Probably forgotten. Like I hate that sense that people are mad at me. Like, I'm very much a people pleaser. So I'm going to go with forgotten.
Okay. Yeah. Who was your first celebrity crush?
Can I say, like, the entire cast of Disney's Newsies?
Yes.
Okay. I saw that movie in theaters, which is hilarious to me now because it was, like, such a huge flop. And so I don't know why somehow, like, my childhood best friend and I saw that movie in theaters. And that was, like, sexual awakening. I swear, like, watching Newsies in theaters. So I'm going to go with the entire cast of Disney's
Newsies. That's hilarious. I'm going to have to go rewatch that because it's, yeah. Did not have that impact on me.
At this point, I'm like, oh my gosh, they're children. And it's like creepy. But
oh yeah, if it has that effect on me, I'm probably have problems. So, okay. In a game of fuck, marry, kill, you have Idris Elba, Jason Momoa, and Oscar Isaac.
Oh no. Oh, that was so cruel. Because I listen to your podcast and I know it's normally Chris Hemsworth. And I had like what I was going to do and you just, oh. Oh, the agony. Okay. Kill Jason. I'm sorry. Jason. I think that's what I'm going to have to go with. And then fuck Idris and marry Oscar.
Yeah. What would it have been if it had been Hemsworth? Would he have died?
Yeah. Oh, yes, yeah. For sure. Ha. Sorry, Chris.
Got you.
You can thank Sarah for that. She quickly typed it as I was about to start reading.
Sometimes you just get a feeling because we always want to find who can unseat Idris and Jason just out of curiosity.
Yeah.
And Oscar. Maybe he'll have to appear more often because I had forgotten. I just saw Ex Machina and like he's a despicable character in it, but also he dances really well and he's like wiggling his hips a little bit. And I was like, ooh, this is interesting.
He's so intense. It's like even in a movie where he is like not the good guy. If you haven't seen A Most Violent Year, like he is amazing in that movie and like and definitely a morally ambiguous character.
Oh my God.
There's this scene where he shaves and it's like cold shower.
Jenny's fanning herself.
For sure.
You said morally ambiguous and Oscar Isaac in like the same sentence and yes, please.
Yes, it's really good. And Jessica Chastain is his wife and she's amazing in that movie. It's called A Most Violent Year.
Okay. Gonna read that or watch that. What? How does one consume movies? I don't know. Okay. So if we went out to a bar together, what would be your drink of choice?
Whiskey sour double.
Ooh, that's a good answer.
Okay. I'm glad that's acceptable. But yeah. I would say that's definitely my drink of choice when, you know, you check the news at 5 o'clock and you've got that 5, you know, PM news dump and there's like 10 breaking stories. Yeah. Whiskey sour.
We are to the question that we were waiting for, which is what Hogwarts house would you be in?
Oh, I'm a Ravenclaw for sure. My favorite words are, you're right. So yeah, definitely like hardcore Ravenclaw. And it's funny because when I was sorting everybody into their houses, I've not written as many Ravenclaws, at least in my summation of it. I don't think I've written as many Ravenclaws as I would have guessed because that's definitely my house for sure.
Is your husband also a Ravenclaw?
No, he's a Gryffindor.
Oh, that's good. I like Gryffindors. I mean, I am a Gryffindor, so come on. Okay, would you rather have invisibility or super strength?
I think invisibility.
Mm-hmm. What would you do?
I think it would be more useful. With invisibility, I would avoid large groups of people. Because the worst is when you're trying to avoid a large group of people and then you get stopped and someone wants to talk to you and then you're stuck and like I'm terrible at figuring out like when can I leave this conversation. Like I'm just like really bad at that. So I feel like invisibility would be more useful to me than super strength.
Well, this has been great. Do you have anything coming out soon or that you're have in the works? When can we expect a new book from you?
It's going to be a while. I'm an incredibly slow writer. I've been working on a bunch of different contemporary stuff and just like nothing is kind of coming together. So I'm sort of at like a crossroads with a couple of different series. I need to figure out what to sort of focus on or what project needs to be the next one. Genevieve and I are sort of picking away at, the next book in that series. And then we've almost written the next novella, but that one can't come out for a while. So, I would hope that we'll have a book out in January or February, the sort of book that gets teased at the end of Freefall, but we'll see if we get that written, in a time frame that lets us put that out, you know, early next year.
And if people want to keep up with you so that they know when that is happening, where are the best places for them to do that?
So my website is authoremmaberry.com. And from there, like up at the top, there's all my social media links. On Twitter, I tend to be like chattier and more political. I'm almost never on Facebook, so like don't go to Facebook. there's also like my newsletter link, and like whenever we have a new release or whatever, I always post about it on the blog.
And you recently got an Instagram, right?
Yes, but I have not been using it for very long, and we'll see sort of if that keeps up. But like I often like photograph like what I'm cooking or like my chickens or like other things like that. So like if those are interesting things to people, that's where you can find that stuff is on Instagram.
Or a pretty exciting Jello mold that we
the Jello mold. Are you talking about the phallic yes. lobster? Oh, the phallic lobster. That was
what the
so every time
Sarah hasn't seen it, I'm gonna have to pull it up while we're sitting here. But
it's so funny. So like every it was unintentionally funny. And the hilarious part was that like the fact that it looked like a dildo, like did not occur to me until I had posted it. And then people were like, Emma, look at that lobster. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. So every time we do a Fly Me to the Moon book, like I always make a Jello mold. That's sort of become like the tradition. And so I had bought this mold that looks like a lobster. And I was thinking that like Vivi in Free Fall is like really like vivacious and she's a sorority girl. And I was like, if you put fizzy stuff in Jello, it preserves the bubbles. So like if you do champagne or ginger ale, and I was thinking it would be fun to do like fizzy pink Jello. So like pink lemonade plus like Sprite or something. And so I made this Jello mold and I put strawberries in it too. And I molded it and it was really light.
It's like flesh tone.
Like I didn't add flesh tone. And the definition on the mold, like in the picture, did not show up at all. And so it looks really.
It looks like a cock and balls.
Explicit. It totally does. And so as soon as I posted the picture, everyone was like, babe, like, no. And so I ended up putting it on the blog and then making like another Jello for release day because I was like, this is unacceptable. Like, I cannot like proliferate this image on the internet. I'm going to get in trouble.
I really want to see what the lobster mold look like. I don't see a lobster at all. There is only a cock and balls there for me. So it's marvelous. I'm a fan.
I think the balls are slightly pointy. I think that's the only indication of lobsters that maybe they were claws at one point.
Yeah, I'm going to have to use that mold again in like a ridiculous color, like bright green or like bright blue or something so that it wouldn't be as like, yeah, pink was like such a strategic error.
Okay, well, on that note, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Emma. And the most recent book is Free Fall if people want to go and check it out.
It was like, absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.